Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for September's Nurses Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce you to our speaker for today, Certified Veterinary Technician Specialist in Cardiology, Charlotte Pace. Thank you, Charlotte. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you very much, and welcome to this talk on everything you wanted to know about ECGs. So what we're going to cover in this section is a brief overview of understanding the reason for performing ECGs. We're going to look at the conduction system within the heart, because that will help us understand what's actually going on in the heart. And then we're going to apply that knowledge to ECG chases and also to patient-based scenarios. And what we'll do then is develop nursing plans based on the application of that ECG interpretation. So really starting off with the basics. So what is the point of taking an ECG? It's very simply to determine heart rate and rhythm. So obviously we can count heart rate if it's slow enough, but sometimes obviously, and particularly with cats, we can't count it fast enough, but we're also looking at the rhythm as well. So why might we want to take an ECG? Well, it's gold standard, as I'm sure most of you know, for anaesthetics to have an ECG attached whilst performing anaesthesia. We also would recommend that emergencies have an ECG attached as well. We also look at post-surgical cases, so things like splenectomies. These cases have been shown to have ventricular arrhythmias post-surgery. But perhaps probably one of the more common reasons is because there's an arrhythmia suspected. So that could be because clinical signs indicate that there might be an arrhythmia at certain times, or it could be that either ourselves or veterinary surgeons have heard an arrhythmia when they've been auscultating the patient. Otherwise, if we're thinking more electrolyte imbalance, so perhaps things like hyperkalemia, and we might be looking there at cats with blocked bladders or with a suspected Addisonian crisis, so we might look at an ECG then. And also finally, if we have patients on antiarrhythmics, so we might be looking at how those are actually affecting our patient long term, so if we're assessing drug therapy. So again, continuing with our basic overview to make sure that we're doing the right thing. So our patients should be in right lateral recumbency, as you can see in this slide here. The electrodes should be placed, so we're looking at right red on the right four, and then the way I remember it is traffic lights round to the left. So red right four, we go to yellow on the left four, and then green on the left hind and black on the right hind. Now obviously some ECGs, as I'm sure you're aware, have different numbers of electrodes that will attach to the patient. So some have three, some have four, some have five or even six, and obviously there's more than that if we use a machine designed for humans, up to 12 leads. What we're really looking at and the difference that that makes is that we always need one of them, one of those electrodes, to be our earth. So it would just allow us to it'll allow us to see how many of those lines or those traces we can see on a screen at any one time. So if we have three, so one is our electrode, we'll only be able to see lead one or lead two. If we have four, as in this picture, we'll be able to see three leads, and then our fourth is our earth. So that's knowledge behind that. What we do want, again, as you can see in this picture, is your patient on a non-conductive surface. So this is just a vet bed on the floor. We also want those limbs to be not touching each other, and also that the leads don't touch each other as well. Anything, so movement or shaking or muscle tremor, or even with cats sometimes purring, that can affect our ECG chase, and they can move those electrodes, and that can obviously impair our interpretation. So when we start looking at the conduction system, so what should be familiar to us is looking at the P wave and then the QRS and then the T wave at the end. Generally, if we're looking at more than one lead on a screen, or we're able to choose which lead we want to look at, ideally we want to look at lead two. And so if your patient is in the position that we saw on the gold standard one on the slide before, then that should just be lead two. So just to recap the conduction system, so I'm sure you all remember that your SA node is in your right atrium. Then we've got the AV node just above the atrioventricular junction. And then we have our HISP bundle. And just to make this a little bit more understanding the actual complex itself, the QRS, I'm actually going to break that HISP bundle down into right bundle branch and left bundle branch. But all of this is part of our Purkinje fiber network. So in our textbooks, we would learn the HISP Purkinje fiber network. I've literally just split that down so that you can see the left and the right bundle branch, and that just helps understand the conduction system itself, as you'll soon see. So we're looking first of all at the supraventricular region, and so supra just purely means above the ventricular region. So we're going to first of all look at the P wave and then something we call the PR interval. So we start off with the P wave. So as you know, we have our sinoatrial node, and those are specialized pacemaker cells that fire from the right atrium. And this impulse spreads across the right to the left side of the atrium. And so because our muscle mass in our atria is smaller than our ventricles, we get this small curve on our trace. So that's our P wave. Then we have our PR interval. We don't worry so much about this, but this is just purely where we have the conduction of that impulse as it goes through the AV node. So there's no myocardium depolarized in this section, so there's no movement actually on the ECG trace itself. It's purely as we have that the first bits of those that conduction going through the AV node. So then we could move on to the ventricular region. So in the ventricular region, this is our main part. It's also, if we think of our anatomy, our main muscle mass. And so we've got a Q wave, our R wave and our S wave, and those are all parts together. Then we have the ST segment, so that's literally just the pause between the QRS, and then we have our T wave at the end. So first of all, with our Q wave, so we have our early impulses come through the AV node and they're transmitted via the left bundle branch. So the net deflection of that Q wave is purely from the left to the right of the septum. So now we move on to the R wave, and so this is still part of the same complex. So this is where your Purkinje fiber network meets both ventricles and they both depolarize simultaneously. And so the R wave and the main part of our Purkinje fiber network, that's a large part of our myocardium, and so that's the part that will depolarize the main muscle mass. Then we go on to the S wave, and so the S wave is purely the basal regions of the free walls and the septum, and they're the last to be depolarized. So it really is just that last push of the ventricles. So then finally we have the ST segment, and so that is where our complex returns to baseline. There's no muscle depolarized, it's just where the complex returns to baseline. And then finally we have the T wave, and so this is where the ventricles repolarize. So at the moment they have they've depolarized, they've pushed the blood out through the aorta, and now the conduction system tells the muscles that it can relax so that then it can refill to go off again. So this is just purely a repolarization of the ventricles ready to start again. Okay, so moving on to how we approach our ECGs and how we approach the interpretation. So the first thing that we do, and I know this is very tempting to just straight away look at it and think, oh my goodness, but the first thing we really need to do is look at it and think, what is the rate? So we really want to identify whether it's the trace is bradycardic, whether it's normal, or whether it's fast. And so here is just a what I use as my guideline for heart rate. And so this is your going through that's from adult dogs through to cats. Now, we might vary on what we think is normal. And again, a cat that's stressed in a practice will probably be the higher end of normal. But I'm just using these rates as a guideline so that if we say, for example, had a toy breed that had a heart rate of 60, or if we had a giant breed that had a heart rate of over 200, we'd know that we're starting to see problems with the heart rate. So the reason why, or the approach that I take to the rate is that we can then start to look at, use an algorithm to look at what that actually means. So if we look at a bradycardic rate, if we've decided that a rate is bradycardic, we can already start to take out other parts of this slide. So for example, a bradycardia, so if we look at something like a sinus bradycardia, so sinus meaning normal, then we can see that we've not got anything more sinister like a ventricular tachycardia. So it forces us down a route where we could have over 20 possibilities. We've now moved ourselves down to sort of 5 or 6 possibilities. So if we look at this trace, we're going to use this trace as just our sort of basic or baseline trace. So just as a simple guide, so this heart rate, this is an ECG that I took myself of a greyhound. So a greyhound in practice with a heart rate of 65. And so with that as a heart rate, and hopefully you're thinking for yourself here, that this is a normal rate. So this would just be a normal rate for a greyhound in practice. Okay, so now we've decided whether our heart rate is fast, slow, or normal. So now we're going to go on to the next part of our interpretation. Now the next few questions are going to come together because they do all relate to each other. So we're going to have the next 3 questions now. So we're going to start looking to see whether there's a QRS complex for every P wave. Then we're going to see if there's a P wave for every QRS complex. And then finally, we're going to see if they are consistently and reasonably related. From what we've looked at the conduction system and how that conduction system works, we know that we should have a P wave for every QRS, we should have a QRS complex for every P wave, and that they should be consistently and reasonably related to each other. So if we take our standard ECG here and we look to see whether or not we have a P wave for every QRS, if we look to see if we've got a QRS for every P wave and whether they're consistently and reasonably related, we can see that we have P waves, we can see that we've got QRS complexes, and we can see that they are consistently and reasonably related to each other. Okay, so the next question that we go to is, if we have any problem with this, we can then use an algorithm again. So do we have a QRS for every P wave? Well, if we don't, we then move to certain answers here, and used in conjunction with our first slide, so our rate, we can see, right, okay, do we have a QRS for every P wave? No, we don't. It's a slow rhythm, so that will give us either second degree AV block or a third degree AV block. If we do have a QRS for every P wave, we're then going to move on to the next question as to whether or not they're consistently and reasonably related. To our third question, do we have a P for every QRS? We do exactly the same thing. So no, we don't. So we've got a list of things there as to that could be our possible rhythm. And again, we can compare that with our rate slide. And so we can see those first two. So atrial fibrillation is a fast rhythm. Atrial standstill is a slow rhythm. So we can start to rule those in or rule those out. So we can see there that we've got P for every QRS. And if we do, that we come back to our original. I do apologise, I'm having a sneezing fit. Right, so if we have a P for every QRS and a QRS for every P, we then ask our next question as to whether they're consistently and reasonably related. And if they are, then we come down to our final answers. So sinus rhythm, sinus arrhythmia, sinus bradycardia, supraventricular is a little bit more difficult. and whether we have atrial or supraventricular premature complexes. So you can see by working out our rate there that we should come to an answer. And if we don't have them consistently and reasonably related, then we could potentially have a third degree AV block, which is a slow rhythm, or a fast rhythm, which is ventricular tachycardia. So then finally, our next question, or our last question, is what is the QRS morphology? So we're looking at whether the complexes themselves, so the QRSs are actually narrow and upright, or whether they're wide and bizarre. So an example of this, on the left you can see that our QRS complexes are tall and narrow. And then we have on the right hand side there wide and bizarre. And sometimes we can get quite caught up at wondering whether something is wide, whether the R wave itself sort of is a wide shape. However, there is a second part to that, and it does make it easier if we think, are they wide and are they bizarre? And you can see the contrast there between tall and narrow and wide and bizarre quite easily. So what does it matter whether they're wide and bizarre and whether they are tall and narrow? Well, it really just comes back to the conduction of our heart, and we can see what's actually happening. So let's imagine that we have a complex that's tall and narrow in origin. And so we see when we've got something that's perhaps an early complex that we have something here. So we have this mark here, that it happens before the SA node has a chance to fire. Now, with this particular focus that set off that early complex, it still needs to go through the AV node and then through the Hispokinji fiber network. And so it will generally look as a normal complex. So this is an example of a what we call an atrial premature complex, or a supraventricular premature complex. And you can see the first one is normal, so you have a P and a QRS. And what you have there, the second complex, has occurred before the P wave has had a chance to fire, but it still looks relatively normal. It's still narrow and upright, so we can work out that our origin of something that is early is purely that it's come from the atrium, and it's just effectively overridden the SA node there. On the other hand, if we've got something that looks wide and bizarre, then we can have a ventricular origin. And so if we have, let's say, our foci is here, and the complex has to travel across the ventricles as it does here, so it's going to take longer because it's not using the established conduction system. So on our ECG trace, if our ECG trace is marking time across the trace, then this is going to take longer to travel to the QRS system. It's going to look wider, that's our time, and it's going to look bizarre because it's not coming down through our AV node, so it is going to look different. Now, the thing is with a VPC or a ventricular rhythm at all is that it can have different foci. So it can come from the right, as you can see here, it can come from the left, it can come near the AV junction, so it can look almost relatively normal. So it is quite difficult. So here I have some different traces where you can see that depending on the origin of that ventricular complex, where the complex will look different. But you can see in all three of those that those complexes are different. They are looking bizarre compared to the normal complex that you have there. So hopefully that makes that the morphology question a little bit simpler to work out where that's coming from. So if we come back to our sort of standard ECG that we've been looking at, so we've got our heart rate of 65, so we've said that that's a normal heart rate for a greyhound. We've got P and QRSs that are consistently and reasonably related, and we can also see here that our QRSs are tall and narrow, and so this itself gives us a sinus rhythm, and again, as I said, sinus meaning normal. So the things that we worry about, and this is where we now start to apply our knowledge to traces that we see and also to patients that we will nurse. And so, for example, the things that we worry about are that the rhythm is too fast and that the rhythm is too slow. So starting with this particular trace here, we can see that the heart rate is too fast. This is actually taken from an Irish wolfhound. Heart rate is 200 beats per minute. If we actually look at that in some detail now, if we look at that trace, that we look to see whether or not we can see P's for QRSs and QRSs for P's. Now, we might be able to convince ourselves that towards the end of that trace on the right-hand side, the last two, they may have P waves. We could spend hours debating whether they are or whether they're not. But what we do know, and again, going back to what we did at the beginning there, that QRSs should have a P for every single P, a QRS wave, and that they should be consistently and reasonably related. So if we're having to argue that maybe or maybe not there are P waves there, it's probably reliable to say that we have a problem here. So we haven't got consistent P waves. So the final thing on this one is that our complexes are tall and narrow, so that means that we're looking at an atrial in origin arrhythmia. So we're looking at an atrial tachycardia, and this one is probably one of the more common that we'll see in small animal medicine, and this is what we call atrial fibrillation. Now, atrial fibrillation in humans and in horses is something that can happen sort of on its own or can be idiopathic. However, in dogs and cats, it's usually as a result of atrial stretch. So the left atrium has got bigger due to heart disease. And so if you imagine that when you're when you've got a diseased heart and your left atrium, you've got a congestive heart, so your left atrium gets bigger, and that it is a muscle, so the muscle stretches, the heart doesn't gain any more blood supply, and so the heart doesn't like not having blood supply, and so you will get these arrhythmias. And so your atrial fibrillation, it's either described in an English way as having snakes in a bag. So you think of your atria where you've literally just got all these little firing complexes that are going off. Or as Americans would say, that when you listen to atrial fibrillation or feel pulses with it, then it feels like tennis shoes in a laundry machine. And it is that really chaotic sound, and it's very, very fast. Now, with your tall and narrow complexes, this means that you've got 200 beats which are getting through the AV node. The atrial rate could be as high as 400. It's what's actually being conducted through the ventricles. That's what we can feel when we feel a pulse, and that's what will give you that erratic feel about this arrhythmia. So if we have a look at this next one, so we've got here complexes that are wide and bizarre. It's a heart rate of 300. This is a boxer that was in our clinic. And so what we're really concerned about, we've got some strange things going on here, but what we're particularly worried about is the section that's arrowed here. We've got no discernible P waves in this section that is arrowed. We've got wide and bizarre complexes going on here. Now, this is an arrhythmia called ventricular tachycardia, because we've got wide and bizarre complexes, which means it's wide, that it's a ventricular in origin. But what we can see here is that we do have a normal complex. So at the beginning of that that trace, you can see that we've got two ventricular complexes. So on their own, like that, be known as a couplet, where you've got two ventricular complexes. Then it breaks, you have a normal sinus complex, which, so basically that's what the ECG should look like, and then you have this longer section. And what we'd be worried about with a ventricular tachycardia like this is that if it's sustained, then it will impair cardiac function. So if you're impairing what goes out through the ventricle, out through the aorta and round the body, then your heart will try and work harder and harder. At 300 beats a minute, it is working as hard as it can anyway. put into that now that you're not getting blood, therefore you're not getting oxygenated blood, you're adding in hypoxia. Your patient with 300 beats a minute is probably collapsed because they cannot maintain that cardiac output. And we're potentially looking that that can degenerate into something we call ventricular fibrillation, which in human terms is usually known as a heart attack. Ventricular fibrillation is basically, it's kind of the snakes in the bag version of the atrial fibrillation. But if your ventricle is doing that, you've got no blood flow going out through the aorta. And so literally your ventricles are trying desperately hard, but you've got no cardiac output. So we can also see two slow rhythms. Now, generally in first opinion practice, when we see two slow rhythms, it's usually due to some form of drug, so drug induced, so anesthesia or sedation. We do also see it in fit and healthy working dogs or agility dogs. Occasionally we can see something like this, and so this is quite an interesting trace that was actually on a Staffordshire Bull Terrier. And what we can see here is that our heart rate is too slow, so we immediately go down that too slow column. We can see that we've got QRS complexes, but they're not consistently related. So if you look at that, that's the end, the first part on that trace on the left is the end of a QRS complex. But if you can see up until the next one, those little indentations, so those are P waves, that's your atria, and that's your atria going off. You can see they're quite regular actually. So we'd say our atrial rate there is about 80, but you can see that we've got these wide and bizarre complexes that you can see two of. That's what gives us our heart rate of 12, because that's our ventricles that are stimulating that that electrical conduction, so those ventricles to go. And so what these actually are, a ventricular, we call escape complexes, because without those escape complexes, then our patient doesn't live. It's as simple as that. So this is a life-threatening arrhythmia. The patient in this particular case was cold. There was no pulse that you could feel, or you could get on a blood pressure. Collapsed ascites because it had been ongoing for a while. And so a pacemaker was needed to take over the conduction of this rhythm. The rhythm itself, sorry, is known as a third degree atrioventricular block, sometimes and perhaps more accurately described as a complete AV block. And that's where you have no connection between the atria and the ventricles. So as you can see, atria are going at a rate of 80, but there's some reason why that's not being conducted through the atrioventricular node. That can be, like I say, it can be idiopathic. It can be because you have something like a tumor across or in the area of your atrioventricular node, which is delaying or slowing down conduction or blocking it entirely. Okay, so we come to what can cause an arrhythmia, because again, obviously as nurses, we always like to be prepared and we can see these things coming. So so obviously the most common thing we have is structural heart disease. As we mentioned with atrial fibrillation, if you have a heart rate, if you have a heart that is diseased and you have congestive heart failure, so you have an enlarged left atrium, you'll be more predisposed to having an arrhythmia than not. But we can also see things like hypoxia, so something we need to be aware of when we're doing anesthetics. So if our tube is blocked, or if we don't have an alarm on our oxygen, say our oxygen's running out. We can also see arrhythmias with inflammation. So if we've got something like sepsis, or if we have an inflammatory process going on throughout the body. If we have an autonomic imbalance, we may see a bradyarrhythmia or a tachyarrhythmia, metabolic abnormalities. We see it sometimes with drugs and toxins. So I'm sure we've all seen our dogs with theobromine ingestion, or things like metaldehyde ingestion, which can give us an arrhythmia. And again, we've probably seen this with either hyper or hypothermia as well. Okay, so one of the main questions that I get asked when I do talks like this is about the anaesthetic risks and arrhythmias. And so again, if we're aware of when we can have arrhythmias, then it sort of helps guide us. So we can see arrhythmias with neoplasia. Obviously, if you've got a neoplastic process going through the body, we can expect to see some nasty things going on where, say, for example, we might do a MET check on x-rays before we take a patient to surgery. It doesn't stop us having changes that very subtle changes that may not be detected. GDVs, obviously we know is an emergency that can give us arrhythmias, but the surgery can as well. We're touching very close to the vagal nerve when we're doing this kind of surgery, so it's something that we would definitely want an ECG on, and we need to obviously monitor closely. Sepsis is another thing that we need to be very concerned about. If we're taking patients to theatre, it can cause us any number of ventricular arrhythmias. GI disease or splenic disease, we've kind of discussed before. Ocular surgery, so we might be seeing things like a bradyarrhythmia if we've got any kind of vagal manoeuvre going on there by pressing or touching the eye area. Adrenal surgery pretty much speaks for itself. Upper respiratory tract obstructions, so not only do we have to worry about the breathing, and obviously the hypoxia can cause that, but obviously if we've got an upper respiratory obstruction, then we can see bradyarrhythmias with that as well. And then of course, and probably something we're very familiar with, would be your drugs as well. So a lot of the drugs that we use can cause arrhythmias, and whether that's something that's just simple or like a secondary AV block or a sinus arrhythmia, or whether it becomes more sinister than that. So if we now come to looking at a couple of cases, so we'll look at Harry. So Harry's a 2-year-old male neutered crossbreed. You can see though that there's mainly some Labrador in there. So that explains perhaps why we need to remove a plastic toy from the intestines. So we start off with our anaesthetic. We have a heart rate of 60 beats a minute. So now we need to think, well, is that a normal heart rate for an anaesthetised healthy dog? We probably agree that it is. We've got a P for every QRS. We've got a QRS for every P. The only thing that we can do if we've been a little bit picky on this ECG is we can see that we've got a couple of slightly longer pauses there. And those pauses can be respiratory mediated, what we can see is we have a sinus rhythm because we've said that our complexes have a P and a QRS, that our rate is acceptable for an anaesthetic, but those pauses would perhaps indicate that we have an arrhythmia. So we would call this sinus arrhythmia. As I've said, sinus arrhythmia can be seen with anaesthesia when you have a slightly slower heart rate. Our question as to what action would you take? Well, if our patient is anaesthetised, then I would be looking at all of our other parameters. So is this respiratory mediated? Is there something painful that's going on? Is it a change from where we were? However, at 60 beats a minute and a PQRS complex like that, we're maintaining cardiac output. And so to me, that means that I'm going to keep an eye, but I perhaps wouldn't change anything right now. So 30 minutes into our GA, we can see the heart rate's dropped to 45 beats per minute. So starting off with our rate there, is it something we're concerned about? Well, I'm starting to take notice because 30 minutes we were 60 beats a minute. We can see that we've got P for QRSs, apart from two P waves that we can see there that are on their own. And so these two P waves that are on their own, so the SA node has fired, but there's not been a QRS complex to follow. So this particular rhythm is what we would call second degree AV block or atrioventricular block. Now, what action would I take here? So I'm now slightly concerned that our rate has come down somewhat, and with this second degree AV block that's developed, I would be tempted, depending upon what's happening in the surgery, I would be tempted to slightly lighten our anaesthetic to see if we could come back to a regular sinus rhythm. However, again, if we're starting to panic or to worry about this kind of thing, then we look at our other parameters. So are we still breathing? Is there any sound to our breathing? So is there any blockage or partial blockage of our ET tube? Have we got any drugs that are perhaps causing this to happen? What's the surgeon doing? Is there any sort of nerve input at this point? Is this a genuine 45 beats a minute? So the action that I would take really would be to look at this anaesthetic and slightly lighten the anaesthetic. Question that I often get sometimes as well is about the differences between what we call first degree AV block, second degree AV block, and third degree AV block. And so first degree AV block is quite a difficult thing to actually tell. First degree AV block has a normal PQRS complex, but with the difference is that your P and your QRS complex are further apart, so you have a delay. So that PR interval that we talked about earlier, that is prolonged. So it's quite normal, but you just have a longer gap than you would expect. Second degree AV block is, as you can see here, so you'll have the occasional P wave that has not been conducted through the AV node. That can either happen fairly randomly, it can happen as part of a pattern, and that then splits down into more complicated rhythms. But again, will that concern what we're doing? Well, if we see what we call a high grade AV, second degree AV block, if we see a high grade second degree AV block, then it can start to compromise cardiac output. And so that's where we would be monitoring blood pressure, we'd be watching all of our other parameters. And then, as we've seen already, our third degree AV block, that's the one that we saw just then, where we've got no correlation at all with our QRSs and our P waves. Okay, so moving on to our next case. So we have Poppy. She is an 8-year-old female neutered West Highland White Terrier. Surprise, surprise, she's got ear disease. So she needs an ear flush under GA. She does have a heart murmur that's been detected, but she is a terrier breed, so that's not highly unusual for us. There's no cardiac clinical signs apart from this heart murmur, which has been picked up on auscultation, and she's otherwise a healthy dog. Okay, so under her anaesthetic, so her heart rate is 100 beats per minute. So our first question is, given what's happening, is 100 beats per minute acceptable with her under anaesthetic? I believe it is. If we have a heart murmur and we've not done any further work up towards it, I'd rather that she would be on the slightly higher end than the slightly lower end of our heart rate under anaesthetic, but obviously making sure that she's anaesthetized properly. We can see that we've got a P for every QRS apart from this rather peculiar looking complex in the middle. And the rest of the complexes, apart from this peculiar one, are all tall and narrow. So the rhythm that we have there, apart from this particular complex, is sinus rhythm. But this one complex here, so we look at our morphology on that one, we can see that it's wide and it's bizarre compared to the other complexes. And again, if we look at where it falls, so we have normal complexes, then we have this complex little bit early on there, and then we have a pause. So basically this has jumped in and it's occurred because it's wide and bizarre, it is a ventricular premature complex. Now, what nursing action would I take at this point? I am not overly concerned because our heart rate is 100 beats per minute. I'd be again looking at my other parameters, measuring blood pressure and making sure we're maintaining cardiac output. But to be quite honest, VPCs or ventricular premature complexes do occur. If she's got sore ears, then that could be a reason for having a VPC or so. And so I would make sure that that becomes nothing more sinister than the odd VPC. Again, if I was concerned, I would be talking to the veterinary surgeon about this. And so then finally, we move on to Kane. So Kane is a 10-year-old male neutered German shepherd dog. He's had a sudden onset collapse and he needs general anaesthetic for a suspected splenic torsion. So something that we can see, I don't know why they like to come in on a Friday afternoon, but generally they do. And so we start to have a look at Kane's ECG. So we're anaesthetized. We've got the first part of our trace there, which is a normal sinus rhythm. So we've got a P for every QRS. But we have this section that's arrowed, and we can see there that that's 300 beats per minute. So I am now concerned about this rhythm. It's fast. And again, if we look at now, do we have P's for every QRS's? Do I have QRS's for every P wave? And are they consistently and reasonably related? I can probably see a couple of P's in there, but my ventricles have basically taken over. So if I do have P waves, these ventricular complexes have taken over, so I can't see my P wave properly. And these are wide and bizarre in origin, so these are ventricular. So putting together the ventricular and the tachycardia gives us a ventricular tachycardia. Now, what are my concerns here? So my concerns here are quite serious. I'd be talking to my veterinary surgeon straight away with this. I would be making sure that this is, seeing whether this is sustained. We maybe have a quick burst of something like this. Maybe because the vet has pulled on something that's painful, maybe my analgesia isn't sufficient, maybe my anaesthetic isn't sufficient. But if I can see that this is happening and nothing's changing about this, and this is becoming what we call a sustained arrhythmia, we would be looking at talking to the veterinary surgeon about lightening, taking off the inhalation agent. We'd be looking at giving something like an antiarrhythmic to try and convert this back to a sinus rhythm as quickly as possible. So we're looking at giving something like a lidocaine bolus. Recommended doses are 2 mg per kg, can go up to 8 mg per kg. And if we are giving something like this, then we'd be giving it relatively slowly, but that we can then watch our ECG whilst monitoring all our other parameters and making sure that this comes back to a sinus rhythm. What we can do and we can suggest is that if we can't get this under control or it does seem responsive but goes back into a ventricular tachycardia, is perhaps setting up a CRI, so a continuous rate infusion of lidocaine, if that's possible. So the reasons why I'm concerned and I'm talking to my veterinary surgeon is, like we said before about ventricular tachycardia, that if this is sustained, this can easily develop into a more complex and life-threatening arrhythmia such as ventricular fibrillation. Ventricular fibrillation is a life-threatening emergency. So this period here is crucial that we act and that we do the right thing in this particular section. So if we think about what makes an arrhythmia life-threatening, so first of all, we're looking at two main reasons why. First of all, we're looking at what we call hemodynamic instability. Now, hemodynamic instability can occur because we've either got depressed arterial blood pressure or we've got increased venous blood pressure. So basically, we are not getting blood moving around the body to oxygenate, to go back into the heart and then to be pumped back out through the ventricles. And if we don't have that happening at a sufficiently regular interval, that can make us hemodynamically unstable. The other thing as well, which is where the ECG element comes out of it, is electrical instability. So that's actually our conduction system. And so if the cardiac rhythm is unstable, so we've got a risk of something like ventricular fibrillation. So that's where our ventricular tachycardia can become a ventricular fibrillation, because your heart isn't, the muscle is not getting enough oxygen, and that muscle will turn from trying to work hard enough into a ventricular fibrillation where it just doesn't know what's happening, and that can be electrically unstable. And we can also see a risk of asystole, so our bradyarrhythmias. So the ECG that we saw earlier, whilst that's an extreme example, if we didn't have that ventricular escape complex, and goodness knows why that escape complex is working, so that can stop at any time. And so that obviously predisposes us to asystole and to other bradyarrhythmias. So those are the two main reasons why we're concerned, and can help us decide whether something is okay, whether it's urgent, or whether it's something that is life-threatening and we need to start doing something about it. So one of the questions I quite frequently get asked is about immediately life-threatening arrhythmias. And so we look at four particular life-threatening arrhythmias that we need to immediately start CPR on. So the first one is ventricular fibrillation. We've talked about it a little bit so far. We can see here that there's two traces here. The top one is what we call fine ventricular fibrillation. The bottom one is what we call coarse ventricular fibrillation. The main overriding thing here is that this movement on these two traces are your ventricles. And you can see, again, thinking back to the beginning of this webinar, if you think about what was normal, so that PQRS, what we have here are ventricles that really don't know what they're doing. They are not providing any cardiac output, or very poor cardiac output, if anything at all. And so what we need to do here, if we've got this, we can immediately feel for a pulse. There will be no pulse related to this, because literally the ventricles are fibrillating. They're doing the bag of snakes thing. And we need to start CPR. The next one that we would be concerned about is something we call pulseless ventricular tachycardia, or flutter. In an emergency situation like this, the difference between tachycardia and flutter is absolutely irrelevant. We're looking to see whether or not we have a pulse. Again, the thing that will show us on our ECG is that we have a fast, wide and bizarre tachycardia with no corresponding pulse. So if you see anything like this with no corresponding pulse, we immediately start CPR. Then we go to the bradio, the asystole versions of life-threatening arrhythmias. So again, you can see that there are two versions here. So the top version, if you kind of screw your eyes up a little bit, you can see that you've got P waves. So those are P waves, but obviously a P wave is absolutely useless without a QRS complex, because your QRS complex is what is pushing blood out through the aorta. And so without that happening, your atria just working is asystole. It's nothing of any benefit whatsoever. On the bottom trace there, you can just see that there's no coordinated movement there whatsoever. That could be somebody jumping on a chest creating that thing where they're with CPR, or it could just be movement on the with respiratory movement chain stoking that's causing that movement on that trace. What we can also get, just as we can with a ventricular rhythm, is that we can have a pulseless bradyarrhythmia. So again, this is a slow rhythm that you can see on both of these, whether you just have these escape complexes that are giving you no pulse whatsoever, or on that bottom one where you can see that you do have some form of P wave, but you have these what's described as tombstone appearances. The important thing is, again, if you see something like this that's slow, doesn't look normal, feel for a pulse and start CPR immediately. So hopefully it's a little bit clearer now as to what becomes a life-threatening arrhythmia. Okay, so if we're looking at what's at risk, when should we be worried, when can life-threatening arrhythmias occur? Well, I mean, as a rule of thumb, as I'm sure you're all aware listening to this, that no animal reads a rule book. And so it can be, you know, a healthy animal that's come in for, you know, for a routine spay or routine castrate, and something happens and we don't know what that something is, but we can lose them on the table. And so, you know, I mean, I would argue that whenever we're monitoring anaesthesia or when we have a patient in hospital, we need to be looking out for these things anyway. I mean, if we're looking at specific high-risk procedures, then we're looking at our critical patients. So these are our patients that have trauma, that have a systemic illness. We also look at anaesthesia. As we said right at the very beginning, anaesthesia is for a gold standard anaesthesia, we should have an ECG attached. Anyway, it gives us an idea of what's going on. The drugs that we give will affect that anaesthetic. And so, you know, do we need it? Is it necessary on a routine procedure? Well, you know, what I find that it does is it just helps practice. If we do it on every patient that we have under anaesthetic, or even most of them, then we will start to recognise what's normal and we can jump when we realise that there's something abnormally that's wrong. And obviously heart failure. So life-threatening arrhythmias with heart failure, little bit more tricky to work with, unfortunately, because a life-threatening arrhythmia is a result of heart failure. There's a lot of effort on the heart there. And, you know, there's not many drugs that we can use that can get us back to a previously healthy state. The fact that the heart has gone like that is as a result of an already overworked heart. And that can be quite difficult sometimes, that the decision is made by the vet that you don't resuscitate because of the extent of the heart disease. So those are cases that we are sort of looking at. When we think about life-threatening arrhythmias. So really, just to sum up what we've talked about. So, I mean, my general advice would always be that don't panic. Easier said than done if you've got a crash or you've got something that you're looking at. But obviously, the calmer we can stay, the easier we will think and the more logically we will think. You know, when we start looking at it, we're starting to look at that heart rate first. Is this something I need to worry about? If we're not looking at anaesthesia, if we're looking at our patient, what's my patient telling you? You know, is my patient standing and looking at me, but it's a bit puffy? Okay, this is something that needs to be dealt with, but it's not life-threatening. If my patient is collapsed on the floor, it's cold, I'm struggling to feel a pulse, this is an emergency and I need to shout a vet and I need to be putting in catheters and dealing with things like that. The thing also, you know, if we're just doing sort of more of a routine ECG, we need to get a good quality trace. So we need to make sure that we know how to put the ECG on. We need to make sure that we've got as clear as a leads that we can do in the electrodes so that we can actually see what we're looking at. If you've got a patient that's shaking or has muscle tremor and you've got your electrodes touching, it can be very difficult to see if you've got P waves or if you've got QRS complexes. My advice would be working logically through the five questions that we've looked at. I have done that for years and years, and that's why, you know, you can obviously work through them quicker when you use them frequently, but it just helps focus your mind at looking and using the algorithms. Equally as well, think what the heart is doing at each stage. So again, tall and narrow means that you've got something going through the AV node, which means you've got something coming out through the ventricles. If you've got wide and bizarre complexes in a collapsed patient, then that means that you've got ventricular complexes and your cardiac output could be compromised. And then also, you know, if we're thinking about what's happening to the patient, so if we're in an anaesthetic and we're doing a particularly painful part, we may be thinking to adjust our anaesthetic protocol. So should we be thinking about splash blocks or our anaesthetic cover, analgesia cover, to sort of compensate what we're doing with our patients, so that we can titrate what our care and our nursing care to the patient as a whole. I hope that you've enjoyed listening to this webinar. That's it for now. I have had a question come through. So the question that I've got, and I must say that this is something that comes through quite often, is that basically in the practice, the person says that in their practice they don't use their ECG machine for ages, and then they need it and they need to know what's going on, and they just don't feel confident with the ECG. And are there any tips? I guess the main tip that I would give in a case like this is really to routinely use it for longer procedures. It can be a bit of a kerfuffle setting up the ECG and getting it right. But, you know, if you do it for a bit spay, where you know you're going to have sort of half an hour or so where you can attach the ECG and get comfortable with what you're looking at, I would recommend that you do that. The more that you do, the better it will become. And the more confident you will come with it. Again, sort of working with the vets, you know, we're not just monitoring an anaesthetic and numbers on a sheet. We're monitoring and discussing with the patient where we're at and what's happening to the patient. So that will help, I think, in working it out. You know, if with conscious patients, if you have an animal like a staff dog that's more than happy to lie around and, you know, have you play with the ECG again, you know, I certainly did that when I first started monitoring ECGs, just to get an idea of working with what it was working with, like with a live patient, because they do move. Somebody does walk in the door and they suddenly like move their heads to see who's come in. You know, if you're a cat, your heart rate will shoot up when somebody walks in the room, because, you know, if you're a cat, everybody's designed to kill you. So, you know, you've got that adrenaline flight and fright response going on. So I would recommend that, really, to help with ECG interpretation. I've actually just got another question that's come through as well, and that's just about the role of ECGs with patients who are collapsed, or that they have intermittent problems. So they're fine and dandy in the practice with you, but they've collapsed on exercise. And so is an ECG useful in those cases? It's a great question, and the answer is that doing an ECG chase is sort of the first thing to do, and it's recommended to do, to give you an idea if there is something that you can see there. But what might be needed if it is an exercise-induced problem, that maybe sort of further workup is needed. Things like a 24-hour ambulatory monitor, also known as a Holter monitor, attached to the patient, so that you can have an idea of what's going on in the heart when they're actually doing the thing that makes them collapse. So if it is something that they become tachycardic when they're out running, where they have a burst of ventricular arrhythmia and then sort of kind of get up and carry on as normal, that will help that if the owners are happy to sort of recreate that with a Holter monitor on. That may well help. It's not something that's sort of generally available in practice, but certainly a discussion with a cardiologist would help you with that, with things like that, that are not always present, and that does show you the limitations of ECG. Right, so I don't have any other questions, so I'd just like to thank everybody for joining us today with this talk. If you have any other questions, then I'd be more than happy to answer them at a later date. Maybe if you contact CPD Solutions, and I'd be happy to answer them at a further time. Thank you very much for listening.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Charlotte for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.